Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. As Election Day approaches, our stomachs are contracting as our minds try to push past worst-case scenarios. With so many critical races too close to call and so much dark money being poured into some pretty scary candidates' campaigns, we need to take a close look at what is at stake for our democracy and our planet, and then get to work to ensure that the fragile movement forward that we've been making in recent years to finally address climate chaos and environmental justice is not undone by who gets elected on November 8th. Today, we talk again with community organizer Julia DeGraw about the differing scenarios we can expect depending upon who wins key races for governor and Congress, as well as local elections. Julia, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I have a feeling that you probably have shared the experience I'm going to share right now. I was at the checkout stand at New Seasons a couple days ago, and I was suddenly filled with fear. And I was trying to figure out, what am I so afraid of? I mean, there's been some hard things in my life lately. And then I realized I'm finally letting myself feel how frightened I am about this upcoming election. And I wonder how many other people are having that sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is an overwhelming kind of sense of dread that a lot of folks are feeling right now. And I think after, the last, when a certain person became the president of the United States of America, it was really traumatizing for a lot of folks. Something happened that we never thought was possible. You know, the Supreme Court making really scary decisions about women's and people who can give births autonomy is frightening, right? And then you have at the state level a gubernatorial race where, you know, progress made on existential problems like climate change and, you know, justice issues and environmental justice is completely hanging in the balance. We could be moving backwards in this state in a way that I think a lot of us thought wasn't possible. So it's scary. People are losing sleep. For sure. I'm losing sleep.
But what I want to do today, now we're speaking on Friday, November 4th, so there's still four more days till the fateful November 8th election day. And actually, when some people get to listen to this in other parts of the region, the election will be over. So I want to both talk about what we're seeing in the last few days and the build-up to the election, and then also thinking about the options. And maybe we should be weighing both sides of the option barrel for what happens after the election for those listeners who get to listen to this show after the election. I mean, I want to focus a lot today on the environment. And I've been thinking about how slowly Oregon and Washington, for that matter, and probably California too, have really moved on climate issues, even though the states are all controlled by Democrats. And if we're having this much trouble getting as far as we've gotten, then what's going to happen if we suddenly have Republicans running the show? So first I wanted to talk about, despite my concern about how slow things are moving, the actual achievements that the climate lobby has made to really address the seriousness of climate chaos and how that's at stake.
I'm really glad you brought this up. there's been a pretty major shift in how climate, frankly, polls, which is a very cynical thing to say, but people are really fired up about climate. And that has changed the energy from the Democratic Party around climate. And they're a lot more serious and moving a lot quicker than they were in the past. And Governor Brown, when she passed the executive orders on climate, launched us into 2 years of rulemaking. And it was a lot of work and organizing that went into it. But we're finally at this place right now where that executive order has been almost fully implemented, is taking place. We passed massive legislation that's going to move us to 100% clean energy, on the fastest timeline in the nation. We got that through the state legislature. There is a lot of momentum on climate that needs to be built on because, as we all know, the timeline is short, right? Climate change is here. It is happening. We're at a mitigation phase, frankly, right? We're not stopping climate change. That's not a thing. And so we literally have two gubernatorial candidates, one viable and one not, who are saying that on day one, they will unwind the governor's executive orders. I mean, that's that's what we're facing, right? And it's like, and we have, and with the Kotek, the Tina Kotek campaign, you have somebody who not only is going to support the continued implementation of those policies, but is ready and willing to build on them and recognizes the need to do more. So that's just such a clear contrast that cannot be ignored in this election.
Now, I haven't been tracking this as closely, but are you aware of the legislative races and how those are panning out? Because we've also have gotten pretty used to having these supermajorities of Democrats in the state legislature, and I'm wondering if that's also in the tipping point now.
It is. There's like almost no chance of the House flipping at the state level, but we will probably lose a couple seats. There is a small chance of losing the majority in the Senate. I believe we're going to eke out a majority there. But, you know, we've got to see this all the way through to Election Day, and people got to show up and knock on the doors and phone bank and do the things, right? You know, but the majority will probably be smaller, but we believe we can hold it. It's the governor's race that's the real nail biter right now.
Yeah, it's interesting because it started out, it didn't seem like it was going to be that close. And this is a case, I think we can call out a certain billionaire in the state who I think has really helped shape the closeness of the race now, and that's Phil Knight.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to talk a little bit about that momentum. I know that you work with an organization that is very much concerned with campaign finance, among mm-hmm. other things. So how does someone like Phil Knight get to play such a big role in shaping who can be our next governor?
I actually want to take a quick step back, though, and say that folks, I know people in Oregon politics, including at the Oregon League of Conservation Voters and others, who knew from the beginning that Betsy Johnson was a real threat to spoil the election. And it was really frightening to see how late, you know, the National Democratic Party and others suddenly realized how much they needed to step it up to win this race. Like, we knew. A lot of folks who do this work knew, you know, and just were not kind of taken seriously until the money flowed. And Betsy Johnson, who had been a Democrat for a very, very long time and operating at very high levels at the state legislature as the head of Ways and Means, killing almost every environmental bill that she could. I mean, she would eliminate DEQ, the Department of Environmental Quality, if she could, it feels like. When you have a candidate like that who gets millions of dollars from, you know, a Phil Knight, it really enables them to try to appeal to independents and frustrated Democrats, right? That we need something different for the state of Oregon. And you put, you know, millions of dollars behind that message, and this is what happens. You get a person who takes, you know, 15% of the vote and it gets really, really, really tight, you know? And people want to sometimes cast blame, you know, to some degree on the Democrats. But in this case, if you look at the numbers, it wouldn't be that tight of a race if it weren't for Betsy Johnson. So it's a really... there's a really interesting Vox article that talks about this. We are the testing ground for this tactic of running an independent candidate in a Democratic state as a spoiler in order to get a Republican elected, right? And that's another reason why it's so important for us to prove that it won't work, because this is going to be something we see replicated elsewhere if it happens here. So we really are the tip of the sword on this really nefarious tactic. And I also think one really, really important point, if there was ever a case for ranked choice voting or some alternative form of voting that actually represents a majority perspective, this is it. But yeah.
Well, I got a sense of just how dangerous Betsy Johnson was, the role that she was playing, when I was talking to a couple of friends last summer who are very politically savvy, but obviously don't spend much time along the coast or in Columbia County. They had no idea who Betsy Johnson was. Mm-hmm. And they thought she sounded like a real feisty, great woman. I said, you know, she owns a machine gun. And I started telling them about how destructive she's been on a lot of environmental issues on the coast, not just environmental issues, of course, gun control, and a lot of other things. And it was really news to them. And I felt like they were a little, like, suspicious of what I was saying. And later on, they heard it. But I was thinking how back in the beginning of the summer, if more people had been savvy to who she was, I think things would look a lot different. And you could maybe blame a little bit about that on the Democratic Party. But the other part of it is much bigger than that. It's that people in Portland don't pay attention to what goes on around the rest of the state. Unless you've been involved in campaigns like this campaign to stop Jordan Cobell and G, or other things like that, or spent time trying to stop the LNG facilities they were trying to build in Clatsop County a number of years ago. So I think people who are really very active in the climate struggle knew who Betsy Johnson was, but people who are more mainstream political didn't. So how do we get people to maybe pay a little more attention to what's happening around the rest of the state so that when someone like Betsy Johnson pops up, they'll know what this really is about?
I think this is true of all politicians, though, and the nature of voting and of folks don't think about politics except for around election time. And I mean, people barely know and sometimes actually don't know who their county or city elected officials are. So I think expecting your average voter to be tracking politicians from other some people don't know who their state representative is, right? You know what I mean? Let alone a state representative from another part of the state. So I do think that, like, by just default of the fact that, you know, your average person, and this is not a critique either. This is just people are living their lives. You know, I think you're not going to bother to try to learn about a person like Betsy Johnson unless she's running for governor, you know, and it's just the nature of politics. I'm not really sure how we get around that. And I don't know. I agree with you about the electorate, but Portland area state level politicians do a very good job of trying to think about the rest of the state. They are constantly trying to engage on rural issues. So I do feel like there is a lot of misinformation about the urban rural divide that is just not really founded in reality.
I sort of had an interesting anecdotal experience. Around the corner from where I live, there was the first Betsy Johnson lawn sign got put up in the person's yard. And I don't know those people that well. I was not totally surprised. Then a couple weeks later, the gun control lawn sign in support of the gun control bill or initiative came up. And I've been meaning to talk to that guy and say, do you know that Betsy Johnson owns a machine gun and that she has an A rating from the NRA? Well, about 2 weeks ago, the Betsy Johnson sign went down. The gun control sign is still up. So I'm wondering if this is one person who suddenly kind of got it.
I think we're actually helped right now by the fact that nationally, the state has become really interesting because of this spoiler effect of Betsy Johnson. And I think for all of the moderates and Democrats, independents and Democrats who were wanting an alternative to a Democratic candidate, when they suddenly realized that a vote for Betsy Johnson is the equivalent of a vote for Drazen, they were like, oh, actually, never mind. You know what I mean? And I think that the national coverage and the fact that she's a spoiler candidate is really has been overall helpful in helping make the case, you know, against Betsy. But yeah, so I think that that's a little bit of what's happening. And as always, voter education happens, you know, closer to the election. So folks are learning new information they didn't know before. And I think that that's definitely, in that case, helping, but we'll see. I mean, it's still nerve-wracking.
Well, I wonder, after the election, we don't know what's going to happen as of now on November 4th, but either way that it goes, what kind of lessons do you think need to be learned both by the electorate and by people who are organizers like yourself, who in order to prevent something like this happening again?
I think I alluded to this earlier, right? I think it's changing how we vote. And there is a ballot measure at the city of Portland level that is going to shift us to ranked choice voting. And I think that having a more truly representative voting, you know, way of voting that allows the true majority perspective to shine through, especially if you're going to have multiple candidates. I think that that's going to be potentially a really major issue after this election, even if it works out, it goes, you know, the right direction for people and the environment. It's like, I think this was a big wake up call about like our democracy. So I think that's one. I think, campaign finance reform is another. We got to actually do something on campaign finance reform.
We have to get the billionaires out of campaign financing.
Yeah, you know.
Are you listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFD, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with community organizer Julia DeGraw about the differing scenarios we can expect depending upon who wins key races for governor and Congress, as well as local elections. Mentioning the ballot measure to change our form of city government, changing the city charter, I got a campaign ad today opposing the measure, and then there was one that I got yesterday supporting it. And it's very interesting because they're all quoting the different newspapers that are supporting their side. The pro-charter change group, they quote the Portland Tribune as saying, vote no, even though it talks about the dysfunction of Portland city government. Well, I got this ad today from the no group, and they quote the same ad, and they just quote this thing about dysfunction. And they make it sound like Portland Tribune came out against the ballot measure. And I thought, that is really devious advertising. So I wanted to talk a little bit about that and like to talk about that kind of deceptive advertising that we're seeing in a lot of campaigns.
I mean, I don't know what to say other than that it's weirdly easy to say inaccurate, misleading, and arguably lies in political ads. It's bizarre how much of a free-for-all it is on what you can get away with saying in a political ad. I'm not really quite sure what else to say, but I was just hearing on the radio the other day that dark money, independent expenditures dark money has been used to send out mailers on behalf of Republican candidates, basically trying to make abortion a winning issue, saying that we need to make it illegal in the state of Oregon, which is wild, right? And that wasn't with the permission necessarily of those Republican candidates who that mailer was sent out on behalf of, right? That's what dark money does, right?
Wait, so they're saying that abortion should be made illegal in Oregon?
It was anti-abortion ads, like the mailers that were sent out through dark money, which means that they can't coordinate with campaigns. So they were literally trying to put that issue kind of in the mouths of, the Republican candidates that are trying to win races in those districts, regardless of the fact that they are campaigning on it or not.
You sure those aren't Democrats who are doing that? that's what the Democrats would want to see, I would think.
I can't remember who the funding was. It was like I just heard the ad or heard the tail end of the news on OPB. But regardless, it's just, that's the thing about dark money as well it's genuinely, they can kind of say almost anything, and it's uncoordinated from the campaigns. It's kind of crazy. And people say, if we do campaign finance reform, it's gonna like increase dark money. And I'm just like, look how it's being used right now. It's a free for all already, and dark money is still a problem. So it's like, I don't think dark money becomes less of a problem if you do campaign finance reform. And also, part of campaign finance reform is disclosures, where you have to say where the money, came from. And that's why it's so important to get something like that at the statewide level, because we have a lot of counties and cities that have done it in Oregon, but at the state level, we're not there yet.
Well, what do you think about the charter change? I mean, do you think that, because that's something that I understand is polling pretty well. I'm not sure. And I'm also trying not to pay that much attention to the polls, because I might feel a bit like a QAnon person right now. Don't believe the polls. But there's something about the polls that is making me feel very uncomfortable about the way it's being promoted and the way things are going up and down, up and down. For me, it has more to do with keeping people glued to the news and to the advertisers for the news than it has to do with really educating people about what's going on. But I'm curious about how you feel that the charter change initiative is, how would that benefit the things that we're talking about today, including environmental protection?
Yeah, I mean, it's so clear from the way that the city currently functions, or doesn't function, as someone might say, that we need a more representative form of government. We need to have a way that folks can vote that leads to better representation, more equitable and inclusive representation. And the Charter Review Commission did a lot of research and a lot of work to come to the conclusion that multiple member districts and ranked choice voting were the way to get us there. And to also just, this is the most logical thing you can think of, to make it so that we don't have folks who have to win a citywide election be essentially randomly assigned bureaus that they're running, right? Our bureaus deserve to be run by professionals with long-term visions that are like less politicized. I mean, you can't pretend like anything is 100% not politicized, but this ballot measure kind of addresses all those major issues. You know, people can have a debate about the level of power the mayor should have and the size of the, you know, this expands the size of the council, which we really do need to have more than 5 people representing a city of our size. And folks will quibble over that. But in my mind, in aggregate, this is something that is absolutely going to help improve the functionality and representation, democratic representation within our city. It's really disheartening to see members of the council who are so openly against it. I think that that actually makes it like, I'm worried about how much that may or may not impact, you know, the outcome of the, you know, vote on this charter review. But in my opinion, it's like, it's absolutely going to make the city much more functional, democratic, and representational of the people who live here. And I mean, it's going to take us a while to do that transition, but like once we're there, I'm very excited to see what we can get done.
Well, one of the things that it seems apparent to me that the people that are supporting the charter change represent a great diversity within the city, and every way you can be diverse, everything from age to ethnic background to political stances, in fact. And it seems that the people that are opposing it, well, I looked at the list because I've been getting a bunch of mailers from them, and there's an awful lot of people who were in holding public office 15, 20, 25 years ago who haven't been connected that much to politics recently or that kind of politics. And it just made me wonder and they're mostly white guys. There are some people of color. I was criticized by person who is opposing the initiative when I had him on my show in August for saying that it seemed like it was largely white men who were opposing it. And they do have a few people of color, you know, sprinkled on the mailers letting you see that there's some diversity there. But when you actually look at the list, and I don't see any community groups that are on that list, and I wonder how voters can look at that and how that could help them to maybe form an opinion about which side is really representing the broadest interests.
Right. Right. I mean, I think, you know, at the risk of sounding a little bit cynical, you know, folks who historically have understood how to get things done in that system maybe kind of like it, you know what I mean? And I think it's taken a long time for the real profound dysfunction that is baked into this form of government to show up in Portland, because we have had in the past maybe a few innovative, very interesting, you know, leaders or moments in history where we did something really, really big, like urban growth boundaries and things like that. But at the end of the day, it took a long time for it to grind itself into this kind of failed state, which is where it's at right now. This is the commission form of government does not work.
Well, actually, the people who are opposing the charter change also want to get rid of the commission form of government. That's universal.
Right.
It has a lot more to do with it. A lot of them don't like ranked choice voting, or they really obfuscate what ranked choice voting is. And they also don't like having 25% of the vote get somebody elected to council. And mm-hmm. again, I think that the way that works is not being very well represented in the way that they present it.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the combination, I think people are, both multiple districts and ranked choice voting feels like a big change to them, and they're scared of it. I think that does seem right. And I know there's a lot of conversations about the power of the mayor and things like that. But Portlanders have made it really clear they're not interested in a super powerful mayor, right? So it's like from previous system change votes, like that was the reason why they went down, was each time it was like interest groups that wanted to create a really powerful mayor system that just like Portlanders were not interested. So I think we really, you know, respecting the charter review process and trusting, you know, our community groups to like, you know, lean into this exciting new way of running the city is like the, you know, it's a historic moment for us to really dive into.
I also find it interesting that the opponents keep talking about how we don't want to do it. We don't want to be experimental. What's wrong with experimenting?
Well, and whatever new system they're going to come up with is going to be some level of an experiment, you know, because we won't have done it before in the city. So Anyway, we got to just lean in.
Well, another thing, though, is interesting, and the proponents of the initiative talk about how there's a lot of cities around the world that do this, mm-hmm. and actually think larger entities even than cities. And I'm not sure how experimental ranked choice voting is when and district voting is combined, since Cambridge, Massachusetts has been doing it, I believe, since the 1930s. And that I spent a lot of time there when I was growing up, and spent a lot of time there actually after I was growing up. And I think that's a very functional city, actually.
Right. No, I know, definitely. I think it is also the layering of multiple member districts that makes it a little bit unique. But either way, the data is so very clear about that is one of the best ways to ensure a more diverse representation is to have multiple candidate districts. And I personally think that it's really valuable for someone who lives in a district to have more than one option of somebody they can go to if they need a need met. Like if you are an immigrant woman and you see a woman on council who is a woman of color, whether or not she's an immigrant from your country, but there's just some amount of resonance there you're not going to have necessarily with a white male, right? You know, and it's just like, I actually think it's going to increase people's engagement. It's going to make it easier to run for office, make people feel like politics isn't just for someone who can run a $1 million campaign for a citywide position, right? It's really going to I think it's going to really help increase the democratization and transparency, thank goodness, of how the city functions.
Well, let's talk a little bit about how there's only one city council vote that's going to actually determine a change, possible change on council, because Dan Ryan won his election back in the primary in May. So his seat, which would also be up, is a for sure seat for him. But let's talk about how the race between the current city commissioner, Joanne Hardesty, and her opponent, Renee Gonzalez, would shape up in terms of what are your thoughts about how that might change the way the city is functioning, particularly around some environmental issues?
You know, I have been so laser focused on the state level campaigns. I think that for justice and environmental issues, the door is open with Joanne Hardesty's office, and she's very strong on particularly justice issues and on environmental issues and environmental justice issues. And I'm personally most nervous about Renee Gonzalez's stance on houselessness and the dehumanization of folks who don't have, you know, homes. It's the solutions are very that he's proposing are very dehumanizing and aren't acknowledging the complicated, multifaceted nature of the problem, and therefore what is going to need to be a multifaceted and complicated solution, right? It's like, I just think he's using a lot of shorthand for and making promises he cannot keep about issues that are extremely complicated, and you can't hold just the people sitting in office right now accountable to like a problem that was decades in the making, right? I mean, not that they're not accountable for trying to solve the problems, but it just feels like a very disingenuous campaign about what he thinks he can actually do to solve this problem.
Well, interestingly, the person who's directly responsible for whether people are housed or not is not the seat he's running for.
Right.
It's currently Dan Ryan.
Right.
So he should be running against Dan Ryan if he's so concerned about houselessness.
Right, right. No, and what it really feels like is a very nasty referendum on, you know, Joanne Hardesty, the first Black African-American woman elected to Portland City Council. It's really gross. Yeah. Well, I don't know what else to say.
The Oregonian did this big mea culpa. Did you see this last week about 161 years of doing it wrong about racism and how the Oregonian actually promoted many policies that included Oregon entering the United States as an all-white state? You know that.
I knew that. I didn't know the Oregonian had a stance on it.
And actually, it was Mr. Pittock.
Wow.
Who was he was a white supremacist. Yeah. And so the Oregonian is spelling out all the ways in which the paper was responsible for a lot of horrible racist practices that went on they're still going on. It's because there's a legacy that still affects how the city operates. So I found it interesting that they are making amends, so to speak, at the same time that they're totally bashing Joanne Hardesty.
It's a very cynical campaign, is how it feels.
And it also feels to me that the Oregonian is playing into some of the worst aspects of human nature right now. And I was becoming a big fan of the Oregonian, actually, until recently. But around this election, I've been very disenchanted with the positions they're taking and some of the, well, they've been publishing outright lies about Joanne Hardesty. And then when they backpedal on it, it's in the back page as opposed to being on the front page.
Right, right. Yeah. I mean, they did hold their nose and endorse Tina Kotek for governor, which was a thing.
I think that they draw the line on endorsing election deniers, which mm-hmm. Christine Drazen really is.
Yeah.
So, anyway, you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KPFDU, LPFM, and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with community organizer Julia DeGraw about the differing scenarios we can expect depending upon who wins key races for governor and Congress, as well as local elections. Well, a little bit more about local elections, and then I want to go back to the congressional elections that we're facing here with our brand new district. I was reading the Portland Audubon newsletter yesterday, and Bob Salinger wrote an article about how the city is just backpedaling so badly on a lot of climate environmental issues. The article focused on the city's new floodplain resilience plan, which basically takes out a lot of very important things. And he's talking about how the city's encouraging these basically very greedy developers to just build right up to the riverfront. And South Waterfront is a great example of that. There was supposed to be all this mitigation for wetlands when they built there and a wide enough buffer between the river and any building, and it seems like that's all going by the wayside now. And I've heard Bob say, and I think we'll probably have him on the show saying this in a few weeks, that this is the least environmental city council we've had in 2 decades. I don't know how much you're focusing on Portland City Council, because I know you work at the state level, but I'm wondering, as somebody who just lives in Portland and is watching what's happening, do you have a sense that the city's already going backwards and that this final election, before we may have changes in our charter, could be make or break whether the city just completely abandons any kind of climate and environmental policy?
Well, I don't think the city can completely abandon climate or environmental policy because of, like, the Portland Clean Energy Fund, right? There are, like, certain things that have been brought on by grassroots and environmental justice communities that it cannot be denied, right? But I operate on a couple of, committees and commissions within the city of Portland, and it is insidiously, quietly, the city is underfunding its environmental programs. It absolutely is. And I do think that it is a lack of prioritization to some degree from commissioners. I think that, you know, these state agencies or these city agencies would probably be prioritizing it more if they were getting more directive from their, from their superiors. And this is another case for why we need system change, right? Is you need a director who has like a long-term goal of like maintaining and improving our environmental programs. Cause like, let's be honest, our environmental programs have never been good enough. You know what I mean? It's like, so, but I would not disagree with that. It has been slipping. And I think that, to be fair, you know, the council has been under attack for a long time, you know, whether it's the George Floyd protests and the way the federal government came in and just smacked down, like, you know, protesters, and the way the Portland police did so as well. The fact that the city just looked, you know, we got hammered by the pandemic. The houselessness situation is dire. You know, graffiti is everywhere. There's trash on the streets, right? There's like people are just, this doesn't feel like the Portland that we know and love. And we've seen all this happen under this leadership. And I do think that when the city leaders are feeling all that pressure under attack for all those reasons, environment is always like the first issue that slips off the plate. You know, at the state level, it's true too. You know, when everything's hard and when financial, you know, resources are scarce, the first thing to go is environment, you know, and it's really unfortunate because of how important water quality and air quality and all those things are for actual quality of life in the city.
That's one thing that just blows my mind, that, and it's really true. I mean, one of the things that's happening now that's rather concerning is that we've had for several years now the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. Well, I guess planning and sustainability can't get along with each other. And so now it's going to be planning and then the Bureau of Sustainability. And one thing that Bob Salinger mentions in his article is sustainability is going to be marginalized.
Yeah.
It's going to be all planning. The brilliant aspects of having sustainability and planning together in one department is that planning should include sustainability planning.
Right.
So what does this mean?
Well, I mean, I think there's a similar conundrum that happens with diversity, equity, and inclusion, right? You want to have like departments that are kind of like focused on that, that try to help other departments be better at equity, diversity, and inclusion. Yes, that should be included in all agencies all the time equally. But if you don't have like a set of folks that are really like focused on that, it gets overlooked. And I think similarly, a similar thing happens with sustainability or environment. Yes, not a single policy should ever be passed without thinking about sustainability and climate change and environment. Like any policy at all should have some kind of consideration for equity and justice. But if you don't have like kind of a set of people that are leading and really focusing on that all the time, we're not at a point in time in our culture where that's going to be automatically included.
Well, one of the things I keep harping on that's really been dismaying me was Dan Ryan's decision to go ahead and grant the land use compatibility statement to Zenith Energy, because Zenith Energy said, well, in 5 years, we're going to stop passing oil trains through Portland, and we're going to start sending renewable diesel instead, which, of course, is not something that makes me get really excited about. But the question I have is, what made Dan Ryan do that? First of all, he did it without much input from other departments, certainly without any public input at all. It kind of violated all kinds of promises the city had made to the community, which is opposed to Zenith Energy by the greatest margins possible. And even in a time when people are worried about a lot of other things that are very critical to their lives, like the things you just described, and we're still like into the third year of the COVID pandemic. But Zenith Energy is something that's very destructive to have in Portland. And I just wonder, well, what made it so appealing to him to just trample over all the concerns of so many Portlanders and make this cozy deal with Zenith Energy? And I don't expect you to answer why, but I just want to get your reaction.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a broken record. I think this is a problem of the commission form of government. People who have access in a very non-transparent way to commissioners who have a huge amount of power that is not particularly representative or expected to be, you know, it's not transparent or representative. So think about who has access. You know, I mean, it's like whether or not they've given him a lot of money, there was probably a lot of folks coming into his office on a regular basis and saying really nice words that like made him feel like maybe this was the right decision to make, right? It's like, I don't know, I can't crawl into his brain, but I think it's like there is a power, the commission form of government makes it very, very easy for very powerful interests to have a lot of access and a lot of power while ordinary people and that deserve and need representation kind of don't get included. And the city is, I'm not pretending like it's easy to have community engaged decision making, but you always end up with better results. It takes longer. And people are like, the commission for government's amazing, you can get so much done so quickly, but it's like absolutely, you end up with you know, half-baked or unintended consequences because you didn't have this more inclusive process where you got a lot of, you know, really important and intelligent ideas from people who have lived experiences that are different than yours, right? So I think, I'm even willing to give the benefit of the doubt that there was maybe information that made them feel like this was a really good choice and they just didn't dawn on him to seek more opinions, you know? I don't know, right? But it's just like, it's, you know, there's nothing in the system that forces a commissioner to take into account more opinions, and that's a problem.
Well, one of the things that also disturbs me is Dan Ryan totally contradicted what he said when the city denied the land use compatibility statement to Zenith. And he said that it's time to stop kicking the can down the road. We have to take an action. We have to take a stand now. And then he's kicking it back down the road again 5 years.
Yeah. No, it's disappointing and it's concerning. And people are owed an explanation.
I guess I want to talk about these three races in districts 4, 5, and 6. And 6 is our brand new district. And I think that a lot of us kind of were very hopeful, particularly when Jamie McLeod Skinner ousted Kurt Schrader, who I have to think of as the Joe Manchin of Oregon.
Yep.
And another Democrat like Betsy Johnson, who's against everything that most Democrats support. And it looked really exciting to have, well, at least two real progressives running for those congressional seats. These races have really tightened. And the other day I got an email that the race for District 5, which was Kurt Schrader's district, is like now the Cook Report is saying leaning Republican. And I'm kind of wondering, how did this happen?
Yeah, I don't know. This is where I have been very, very focused at state level stuff. I do have to say, though, that race is leaning Republican. That makes me super nervous about the governor's race as well. Like, it's like, you know, we need that. My guess is going to be that whatever campaign ads they're doing are working somehow.
They're really nasty. I mean, they've been trying to portray Jamie as a terrorist, basically. Oh, now, they had this video. I saw the video of it's this video of her at a protest. I think it's an abortion protest after the Roe v. Wade was dismantled. And then it's merged with this other video of the protests in 2020 where people were trying to tear down the fence around the Justice Department every night. And so, and then basically saying she's a terrorist. And that's the kind of campaigning, that's the kind of campaign ads I think we're seeing across the country.
Yeah. Well, I think something that's important to remember in this moment, though, is that the aggregate polling is what's public. And the Republicans, the publicized polling skews conservative. I think there's a lot of polls that don't get published, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So everything is within the margin of error. And this is like, I mean, and just think about previous elections where the polling was just so very, 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 very wrong. Like the Hillary Clinton Trump election, right? I mean, it just like, so I'm not saying again that polling is not useful, but we are in the margin of error here. And it's so hard to know how the dice are going to fall, you know? But yeah, it's disheartening to see to hear that's the direction that district is leaning.
Because this is where we get to the national picture, where it is very alarming to think about the House going back to the Republicans. It's going to really take us back.
That's the part that like gives me heart palpitations, right? It's like I'm very scared about what happens in Oregon if we don't have a Democratic governor in terms of progress on climate. And a number of things, but at the federal level, if there is a Republican majority in the House, if there's a Republican majority across the board, oh my goodness gracious, but even just in the House, they are going to spend all of their time and all their resources just trying to ruin, like just make Joe Biden look like a failure and investigating all of these frivolous things and using public resources to do so.
They're going to spend a lot of time trying to impeach him. I'd like to figure out what they're going to impeach him for. Maybe forgiving student loan? I mean,
what's really sad and hard for me about this is I want to believe that the electorate, period, conservative or otherwise, would want to be represented by somebody who wants to serve them. But there's all these Republicans at the federal level that are running on I'm going to come after the Democrats platform. And it'll work. It kind of breaks my heart.
I'm still hopeful, though. And we're going to get that to that point in a moment. Yes. Anyway, but you are listening to Locus Focus, the voice of happiness here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KPFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with community organizer Julia DeGraw about the differing scenarios we can expect depending upon who wins the key races for governor and Congress, as well as local elections. So let's talk about, instead of succumbing to all the butterflies and worse that's going through our stomach right now, what can we do in the next few days for those of you who are listening to the show before November 8th? Let's first of all talk about what we do to get an outcome that we want. And then after that, we'll talk about what we would do depending on what the outcome is.
Yeah, definitely. I'm personally, the thing that is feeding my soul right now and filling me with love and hope and light, and regardless of the outcome, that feeling isn't going to go away. I have never ever seen this level of diversity and unity and joy and energy in the Democratic Party in the state of Oregon. I mean, it's like an actual party. Like, and people who, like, were not friendly with each other in the Democratic Party because of, like, they're too far left or whatever. Everyone is showing up for each other, with each other. There's music, there's dancing, there's playing, there's children, there's old folks, there's diversity. It's you know, Elizabeth Warren is coming out, Senator Merkley is showing up, Lizzo is doing a show, like Lizzo. So it's you know, the Decemberists. It's just like, we are, it's vibrant. We are for something. We are building for a future. Republicans cannot claim that. They're not building for a future. They're anti-stuff, right? Like, this is the party for people, by people. And it really feels that way in a way that it never has before. And yes, it takes a boatload of money. I almost swore there, but I kept it together. It takes a large amount of money to run this kind of energetic campaign and have a big party like we're having. But it's like, there was no foregone conclusion we were capable of this. So I just feel really, really good that, like, no matter how this goes, the people of this state who want a better future, who, you know, for our environment and for people, and are, like, not bamboozled by some really nefarious talking points and misinformation, are, like, we're leaving it all in the field. Like, and that feels really, really good. And that means folks are going out and knocking on doors. I'm literally going to do that later this afternoon. In like stormy weather, because
you can't tell me who you're knocking on doors.
Oh, no, I'm not mentioning it. I'm gonna knock on doors. I you know, there's a lot of phone calls being made. There's a lot of donations being made. I hate to say it, but it's like when you got Phil Knight giving millions of dollars to the opposition, like, you know, the Democrat, you know, like money matters in politics. So it's like these are all the ways that you can show up to events, you can do things on social media, you can text bank, like, you know, campaigns have a lot of ways for folks to plug in that feel meaningful. And I think that it is the way that I feel like I did what needed to be done. So, like, there's a lot of ways for folks to plug in for whatever they believe in. And you can do the same thing for the ballot measure campaigns, whatever the thing is that you're really fired up about, you can show up.
Well, one of the things that's making me happy on the national level is reading and hearing about the voter turnout in Georgia. Because that was supposed to be one of the great voter suppression states. But it seems like, okay, so we don't have vote by mail the way we did 2 years ago. We'll just go to the polls.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder, how does that play out for you as an indication that maybe things aren't going to go the way the pundits are saying?
Yeah. I mean, I think I also recently read an article that was really concerned, because in Georgia, you had a whole movement of folks who were trying to, like, call into question the entire, whether or not the election was rigged, right? You know what I mean? They're saying there's only one right way to vote, and they didn't trust, like, the entire system, right? And it's like, if the turnout was large and the folks who are election deniers don't cast a lot of doubt on that election, that does give me hope, because Georgia's was the hotbed for that. Like, I mean, it was like ground zero for like really out of, not based on reality, fears about elections, right? So that is heartening. But I think that's, we need to, not only does it matter who wins, but it matters how people respond to how this November 8th election pans out. I think it's going to really paint the picture, or set the stage for what the next major election season is going to look like.
I'm going to say that even more extreme than Georgia's Arizona, where these armed people with body armor and guns are showing up at ballot boxes and trying to intimidate people. And again, a heartening thing was a judge, and it was a Trump-appointed judge. Well, he didn't do a permanent injunction. He did a temporary injunction that goes through Election Day.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that's an indication that even in Arizona, which is really has a very strong election denial culture going on, and a very violent one, that maybe this is going to help tamp down some of the fears.
And I think we also need to be really vigilant about how we respond to things like the violent attack against Nancy Pelosi's husband. We need to, like, that needs to be major news. We cannot normalize violence, political violence. Our democracy is on the rocks. It's rough right now, you know, and we've got to like really be vigilant about not allowing these those kinds of things to become normalized.
Well, on my phone feed, it's the major news story and has been, and I think it's getting covered really well by across the board. So I'm hopeful about that. Well, my biggest fear, well, one of my two biggest fears is that if Democrats win on Tuesday, or we might not find out for a few days, that there'll be even more violent responses on the part of the far right than there were 2 years ago. And I've just been thinking about how do we respond to that?
I agree. That's one of the major fears is that, you know, when Democrats lose, we kind of like take our lumps, but like when the Republicans lose, it does not go well. And that's, I think what's challenging there is, unfortunately, we need Congress to act in terms of, you know, protecting voting rights. And we need for states to, you know, make sure that their elections divisions have the resources they need to run, you know, open, honest, and fair elections. What's frightening is the state legislatures that are passing bills that would literally politicize the folks that certify elections. It's mortifying, right? So it's like that's the kind of stuff that even if Democrats win, and I don't even know what you mean by that, right? Like in Oregon, like this isn't, we, you know, it's it, it, there's some things Oregon is exceptional at. It is very easy to vote in this state. Women have very strong autonomy in this state. Like we do some things really, really, really well, right? You know, but like in states where their legislatures are actually allowing how elections are certified to be politicized, the Supreme Court's not going to be acting on that, right? So it's like that, you know, there's a lot of solutions that in order to change this kind of direction nationally need to come from the congressional level. And with the filibuster and the supermajority requirement in the Senate, I don't know how we get there.
Well, Julia, do you have any positive suggestions as one final clarion call today?
I think that we need to, well, the big picture is helpful. I think that we are so poised in the state of Oregon to be leaders on every major issue in the world. You know, we can be leading on the environment and on climate change and on justice issues and on innovation. And like, there's so many ways that our state is poised with the right majorities in office to really move the state forward. There's a political will that I feel like hasn't maybe been there in the past. There is a lot of support from the people of the state to create this progress. Justice issues, environmental justice groups and other justice groups and community-based organizations are operating in the halls of power in a way that they just haven't historically. We are really shifting in this state of Oregon the balance of power toward people. And that is so exciting. And we have an opportunity to keep that going this election season. And even if it's the worst case scenario, we can still keep that going. I mean, there's nothing like a fight to unify people, right? So either way, we can keep that going, but hopefully it will be building on our previous wins and blazing forward a path that's more equitable, inclusive, and, you know, better for the environment and creating a future for ourselves. And that will ultimately help the ripple effect out into the world, right? You know, it might be a while before Congress is functional, but we can do amazing things in our state.
Well, thanks so much, Julia, for saying that. And thanks for being on Locus Focus today.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking with community organizer Julia DeGraw, and you've been listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, KODX, LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO in the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible during this pandemic. And you can help us if you're able by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. We're independent, community-supported, volunteer-powered radio. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Next week, we'll talk with Yasha Vasev with Friends of Trees. Thanks for listening. We'll go out with music by Marvin Gaye. Stay safe, get your COVID shots, and remember to socially distance and wear a mask when necessary.
Underground and in the sky, animals and birds who live nearby by the night. Mercy, 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 all things and what they used to be. What about this overcrowded land? How much more we use from man? Can't you stand it?